Hi everyone, and welcome to 4Panel, your weekly guide to the weird and wild world of comics. I'm Andrew, and as always, I'm joined by my co-hosts, Rob and Mick.
Hello.
Hello.
And they even answered in order. It worked. Which is ironic, because speaking of things that work or not thereof, it's the Dark Phoenix episode.
Although,
to be fair, prior to seeing the film, we were just going to call it the Phoenix episode.
Is that you? You've taken a jab at their maybe poor lighting choices.
Yeah, the poorly lit Phoenix is actually a more appropriate name for it, isn't it?
See, I don't know. Because I feel like whoever it is who works in the lighting department who thought, you know what, the less people can see of this film, the better. They're the real hero here.
You do make a fair point. Anyway.
So, I mean, I think we've effectively put our cards on the table. None of us liked this film.
No.
It's not good. It's very bad and quite boring.
I wish I could have gone into this film drunk. Maybe it would have made more sense.
I think we should point out as well, to any new listeners, if you want a spoiler-free review, you're probably best off listening to our companion podcast, Cinema Eclectica, because we are going to spoil this movie more than Fox already have.
Yeah, we are
slapping this movie down the table, we're taking out the scalpels, and we're pulling out all the squishy internal bits.
Which, again, would have made it a far more interesting film.
Indeed. Anyway, shall we get started?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay, so film starts with a flashback of Jean Grey using her powers for the first time, accidentally killing her own mother in a car crash. Then she meets Professor Xavier, and he takes her to his special school, which all of this takes place in 1975, which would have made Jean like 13 years old during the events of X-Men Apocalypse.
Yeah.
So it's nice to see that, you know, the films have maintained their strict adherence to their own timeline. as they are well known for.
Yeah.
Anyway, we then cut to 1992, which the X-Men are going on a space mission to rescue the space shuttle Endeavour, which has got into a bit of trouble out there in the old space, because it's been... it's about to be struck by a massive solar flare. So the team don their new uniforms, which I think we definitely need to pause for a second, point this out, because this is one of, what, maybe two or three times the movie actually references X-Men comics, in that they are wearing outfits very reminiscent of the Grant Morrison and Frank Quietly new X-Men costumes. Which, actually, now that I think about it, is kind of wild. Because it means that the X-Men in this movie are wearing costumes inspired by the costumes from the comics, which were inspired by the costumes from the first X-Men movie.
It's Exception. No, that's one thing it isn't.
Now, what it is the best video game title of all time. Street Fighter the Movie the Video Game.
Yes, it is. Starring that man himself, Jean-Claude Van Pants.
So yeah, the X-Men, they save all the astronauts in the shuttle, but during the mission, Jean gets kind of left behind on the shuttle and is hit by the solar flare, absorbing all the radiation into herself. And I will give the movie credit for one thing. I did very much like the fact that there was a scene where Jean kind of like uses her powers to draw the solar flare away from the X-Men ship and, like, onto her. I thought it was a nice scene of a character acting, at least vaguely in a way, reminiscent of an actual superhero.
Yeah.
That happens. Jean seemingly dies. Then she comes back to life and gets taken back to the school where Hank does some tests on her. Then we cut to a little while later. X-Men, they're having a bit of a happy time dance party. I forgot the scene before that.
Yes, you did.
Where Mystique and Charles have an argument.
Oh.
because Charles is...
With, quite frankly, the most damning attack on misogyny in Hollywood I think I've ever witnessed.
Yep. So the exact scene is, first of all, Mystique is angry at Charles for enjoying the fact that people aren't trying to murder all the mutants too much. I don't understand what the conflict in that scene is.
That bit confused me because I was thinking, well, surely that's something worth enjoying.
But maybe Raven, as she's repeatedly... I don't think they ever call her Mystique once in this, do they?
No, they don't.
No. Weirdly, the only X-Men they call by that actual code name is Storm.
Yeah.
She makes me think, I don't think anyone knows Aurora Monroe's name in this film.
Or maybe they just can't say Aurora Monroe.
There were just too many outtakes of people going, Aurora, remember?
Maybe. This is the 90s, so it was before racism ended.
Yeah, they might have had to put a stop to it when someone accidentally called it Oreo.
Ooh.
Yeah.
So it's also 1992, so it's before sexism ended as well.
Yeah.
As Mystique points out, when she, and I need to point out, turns to leave, is about to go through the door.
She does deliver this mid-flounce.
Yes. Spins back around.
It's a sort of triple reverse flounce.
Yeah, she basically spins round like Columbo and yells...
Or like a badly dressed Wonder Woman.
And yells in the tone of voice that can only be matched by someone who is contractually obliged to be in a film they really don't want to be in, and says, by the way, the women are always saving the men on this team, so maybe it should be called the X-Women. And then there's just like a really awkward pause and the scene ends.
I just wonder if in the director's cut you then cut to a scene of her X-Men sort of sports bra being burnt on a fire somewhere as a final act of defiance against Charles.
Anyway, speaking of defiance, the teens are having a fun time party in the woods. And this scene, God, depressingly, this scene was the entire highlight of the movie. Because after, like, God knows how many decades of Fox failing to put her in a film, finally get a cameo by Dazzler.
Yeah, that came out of the blue.
This is the thing. After all that time waiting for a cameo of that kind, I was waiting to be on this podcast with you to confirm that that's who it was, because it's a fleeting glimpse.
Yeah, basically, you just see her standing in the middle of the woods. Dazzler, for those who don't know, is a mutant with the ability to turn sound into light. So she's doing a singing and making a light show. In the comics, she was initially a disco superstar. And and they actually even do her costume. Like, she's got the white jumpsuit on and the kind of blue face makeup. And actually, thinking about it, I hate that scene. Because I see Dazzler, and she's there, and she looks like Dazzler, and she's using her powers right. And all I can think of, why? Why is the only character you tried with this one who appears in like a 30-second cameo?
And why is it Dazzler of all of the characters? See, I like Dazzler. Don't get me wrong, I actually do like Dazzler as a character. I think she's a fun character, but of all the X-Men characters you'd choose to do right in a movie...
But no.
I'm thinking of my exposure to Dazzler, and I think...
And that's why she filed that restraining order.
I didn't want to be the one to say it.
I knew that joke was coming. But the thing about it is, my experience of Dazzler in comics is actually a 30-second cameo is kind of fitting.
Yeah, that does kind of sum her up in like the modern X-Men comics.
I suppose, see, the thing is, she's more prevalent in other comics than she is in the X-Men comics, isn't she? Because she was a core member of A-Force, for example.
Yeah, I think A-Force was kind of the last time she was properly in the comics.
Yeah, but she's been more relevant in other comics than the X-Men, which is bizarre. Because isn't she supposed to be, like, ridiculously powerful?
Maybe. She's maybe ridiculously powerful, or she's not, and also maybe she can't die, or she can.
Yeah, there's that as well. See,
and she's also either like the most famous singer in the world or a washed-up former has-been.
Yeah. See, I've always been confused about one thing, and this is an experiment that I would love someone from Marvel to just play with. Right, if Dazzler can turn sound into light, how bright would she get if Black Bolt said something to her?
Actually, I was going to say that has happened, and it was kind of rad.
Really?
Yeah. It was X-Men versus Inhumans, or Inhumans versus X-Men. Even remember that? You shouldn't. It was bad.
Yeah.
But it did have one rad moment where, like, Black Bolt is about to attack the X-Men. He opens his mouth. Nothing happens. Turns around to see Dazzler lit up like a Christmas tree, and she just blasts him with a big old bolt of energy.
That's how they should have ended the TV show.
It's fine. They all died on the way back to their home planet. It's just... And again, I really want to stress... You know the X-Men uniforms that we mentioned earlier?
Yes.
Yeah. They are in maybe, like, two scenes... And then the rest of the time, they're just wearing generic clothes.
Basic civvies.
They don't even do the bare minimum Smallville of, like, making them the colours of the superhero costume.
This is true. And just to paraphrase your word from a previous episode, jeans!
So many jeans. So anyway, X-Kids, they're having a fun party time, but then... Jean gets a bit woogly, and her Dark Phoenix powers start to manifest. And by manifest, I mean she gets some red squiggly lines on her head.
Yeah, it started going a bit carry there, didn't it?
Yeah, then she basically learns that her father, who she thought was dead, was still alive, and she's had all this repressed trauma. So she goes a bit loopy and kind of goes to confront her dad. Then she finds out that her dad... deliberately gave her to Charles Xavier because he didn't want to look after her anymore. So she has a bit of a mare. But there's some psychic lifty things about. The X-Men try to stop her. And in the process of the fight, Quicksilver gets very badly injured. And that's him gone. He's not in the film anymore, except for like a brief scene at the end. And also... this will come as a shock to you if you've not seen literally any of the trailers for the film. Also kills Mystique.
Yeah.
And I feel like that scene would have maybe had a bit more emotional weight if I'd not been like sat there whispering under my breath, Genie, you're free.
See, that whole bit where she killed Mystique would have had more weight for me if there was actually a good relationship between the two characters in the first place.
In fairness, the lead up to that scene, the dialogue leading up to that scene,
yeah,
tries to build that relationship. It's just, there's no emotion. It's a contractual obligation speech from Jennifer Lawrence, I feel.
Yeah, well, not just from Jennifer Lawrence, from what's-her-face who plays Jean Grey as well. It just feels
Sulky
like...
Stark.
Yeah, Sulky Stark.
Sophie Turner.
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah, I thought Sophie Turner was actually, she was pretty all right in this film. She just didn't really have all that much to work with.
I think she did as fantastic a job as she possibly could with what is, let's face it, a dire script.
Yeah, the script is just bad. But my point is, when she in those scenes where she's conversing with Mystique, it just felt like both of them were phoning it in. It's like the dialogue was just so bad. They were like, I don't know how to put emotion into this, so I'm just going to read it as if I'm reading an auto cue.
I think, from my point of view, I think that the fault for that lies with Jennifer Lawrence's performance. She's the one who feels like it's a phoned-in contractual obligation performance. Now, the problem with a performance is, it's based on energy levels. You bounce off the energy of the other person.
Yeah.
So she doesn't give Sophie Turner anything else to do. And Sophie Turner, script problems aside, does a fantastic job in all her other scenes.
Yeah.
But all the scenes with Mystique, stroke, Raven, are...
wooden.
Wooden. And emotionless. And I think the whole thing feels like it's Fox going... Ah, we've lost this franchise now. Stuff it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's a shame because, like, I feel like the first half an hour or so of this movie, might actually be fairly enjoyable, if not for the fact that, like, literally all the emotion is centered around Jennifer Lawrence.
Yeah, see, the bizarre thing is, aside from First Class, I've never actually liked Jennifer Lawrence as Mystique. I actually prefer Rebecca Romijn, is it? A Roman? However you pronounce her surname?
Yeah, Romijn, I think.
Yeah, Romijn. I actually prefer her as Mystique.
Which, I mean, yeah, to be fair, though, it's like after First Class is when she got famous and started phoning these performances in.
Yeah, but during First Class, there was actually some emotion there. You know, she might have grown and developed as a character, but then, Hunger Games took off and everything else took off. And...
anyway, speaking of emotion, Jo does get to show some emotion. Jessica Chastain, very briefly.
Yeah.
Because she is playing some kind of rich airhead socialite who then encounters the alien Dabari, a race of aliens whose home planet was destroyed by the solar flare and eventually revealed to be basically the Phoenix Force. Not that the film ever wants to call it that, because heaven forbid it should make comic references in this comic movie. And they are, I want to say, sort of like Skrulls, but plant-like. But it's also hard to tell because they are predominantly in shadow, and then they turn into humans. And literally they spend the rest of this movie just looking like a bunch of generic people.
So, aren't
they... they are... to say they are a race of potential villains who aspire to be one-dimensional, not an understatement.
Aren't the Dabari the broccoli people whose planet she destroyed?
Yep, in the comics, they are aliens who, like you say, look like broccoli. And basically, they're the race that when Jean, or later the Phoenix, first loses control of her powers, she ends up destroying their planet and wiping them out. So they're very minor in the comics. I feel like here they're kind of being used just as a way to kind of combine the Hellfire Club, who were the ones who kind of drove Jean insane in the first place, and then the Shi'ar, who are the alien race who wanted to execute the Phoenix. And I feel like it's potentially an interesting idea, kind of throwing this new spin on the source material. But the problem here is the fact that it means, like a lot of the X-Men films, we're missing out on a big load of quite important characters.
Yep.
And what we're getting instead is just, well, like Mick said, just the most generic, not even one-dimensional, we want the Phoenix because you're evil.
Because power.
Yeah.
See,
and that.
I'll be honest, this entire film felt like the revision notes of the revision notes of the revision notes of the Phoenix saga.
Combined with Jessica Chastain occasionally kind of giving a sideways glance and thinking, I have the worst effing agent.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But that's what it felt like. It felt like somebody had basically taken all the major events and all the important bits from the Phoenix saga and put it all together in like a cheat sheet. And then they gave it to somebody who basically condensed that into an even smaller cheat sheet, who then passed that on to somebody else who condensed that into a smaller cheat sheet.
Well, it's giving the Dark Phoenix saga to someone who just seemingly does not understand why people like this story. Because a big part of what makes the comic work is, like, the central love story between Jean and Scott.
Yeah.
And Scott, like, literally, there's a point in this film where he just kind of stops having lines.
Yes. It's true. It's almost like when they negotiated the contract, he was given a certain number of words to say throughout the franchise, and they'd used them all up by a third of the way through this film.
He's supposed to be Cyclops, not mute.
Yeah. That's why they repeat him yelling Jean so much.
Oh, yeah.
But yeah, but no, like the main problem is like all the stuff he should have done is taken by Mystique and Professor X.
Yeah.
Because this franchise has decided they are the main characters and so everything must be about them.
Again, that's what I don't understand. I mean, the source material is... It's pretty blatant, the relationship between Jean and Scott. And one of the reasons people bought into the whole Phoenix saga in the first place was because you had all of those years of Jean and Scott developing their relationship in the first place. And so when the Phoenix Saga happened, and then, you know, Jean eventually, because it's not really a spoiler, any comic book fan knows what happened at the end. And then Jean eventually has that moment of clarity and turns those Shi'ar guns on herself.
Yeah, and also, we literally 2 weeks ago did an episode about this whole thing.
Yeah, I know. But that's why it was such a shock to all of the fans of the X-Men, because they'd had all of this, all of these years of Jean and Scott being an item and the strength of that relationship, even in the face of a manly man like Wolverine.
And was I the only person praying for a cameo from Logan in this? Just to, you know, just to break up the monotony?
Yes. Yes. Because I was thinking, no, Hugh Jackman's better than this. Unless it had been a cameo by Logan, but he is now dressed as like a circus ringleader.
See, I would have loved that cameo. Or as which character was he in Les Mis again? I've forgotten. He was
Jean Valjean.
Yeah, or as Jean Valjean. He just stands up in the middle of a battle scene going, "Here I am, 24601. And then just runs off.
It wouldn't have made the movie worse. So yeah, basically, Jean ends up getting kind of semi-controlled by the Dabari, almost becoming the Dark Phoenix. At one point, she goes to Magneto. He's running his own little island commune now, which I think is maybe supposed to be a sort of film version of Genosha, the island nation that Magneto was in charge of for a long while. But they never call it that.
No, it's one of the long series of things in this franchise where they almost depict something that they never quite get around to telling you what it is.
Yeah, I was a bit surprised by Guru Magneto, because that's basically what he was.
I did enjoy, but certainly not for reasons that the film wanted me to. Magneto and Jean fighting over a helicopter.
Yeah, that was
they're
cool.
They're both trying to control it with the powers and they just stood there having an epic gurn off.
Yeah.
No, Eric. Your facial gurning is no match for my mighty pout.
Just imagining now, just imagining him on his commune and he's doing his training and someone's going, "Show me pouty face, show me pouty face. We need more pouty face."
Actually, you know, thinking about it, later on in the film, Magneto's a lot more effective. And he doesn't do the gurning. I think he finally understood that the secret to magnetokinesis is blue steel.
I love it.
So yeah, that happens. Then Beast goes to Magneto, kind of tells him that Jean killed Mystique, so they need to go kill her. Which I guess we're just forgetting about like two movies ago when Magneto really wanted to kill Mystique himself.
Yeah. Was that before or after she slept with Magneto?
After?
I can't remember.
Anyway, they have a bit of a brouhaha. Magneto has two new members in his Brotherhood of Evil Mutants. They're Selene and Red Lotus. Who are they? Short answer is it doesn't matter.
Is this the Selene who's like the energy vampire?
In the comics, yes. In here, she's... Well, I'll get to sleep. Red Lotus, I kind of understand.
Yeah.
In the comics, he's like a generic kung fu dude. In this film, he can kind of do, like, weird martial arts, but, like, with his hair tendrils. But it's just... Of all the X-Men characters, why? There are so many villains that you could have just put in there instead. And you went for this... Not even D-list guy. But Selene. Selene is an immortal energy vampire. And this, she's a woman with purple hair who can read minds. And, actually, I have a theory about that. So, rumour has it that during the initial filming of this, they wanted Olivia Munn to come back as Psylocke, who was in X-Men Apocalypse.
Okay.
But she refused. So I reckon... that was probably supposed to be her, and so they just needed to like hastily make a replacement character, which would be fine, except there's literally a comic character who exists in the comic whose entire role in life is like vague, well, like identical Psylocke replacement who you can use when Psylocke isn't available, who's called Revanche.
Oh, yes. Yes, yes.
Basically, she's the woman whose body Psylocke swapped with, which made her Asian.
Yeah.
It's a whole thing. We're not going to get into it.
No, because I remember Psylocke is a Brian Braddock's sister.
She is.
And so anyway, her soul is English through and through.
Yep.
The body anyway, isn't.
We have spent far too long talking about a couple of characters who get like zero lines and are abruptly killed off in the final battle, because of course they are. So yeah, basically X-Men try and stop Jean. They manage to reason with her, stop her from going too dark Phoenix-y. But then they all get captured by the government and put on a train. Boy, you know, I think this might be the most poorly judged joke in the whole film, is that the soldiers who captured them are the Mutant Containment Unit,
yeah,
aka the MCU.
Yep.
Which boy, Fox, no, you have not earned that level of goodwill.
Yeah. I noticed that as well. I was like, it's cringeworthy.
Yeah. Anyway, the Dabari attack the train, and we get that proudest and most sacred of X-Men film traditions, which is a final act in which the X-Men fight enemies who are just a bunch of dudes in jackets. That being said, I thought the train fight was fairly okay. I mean, it might just mostly be because of the absolute dearth of any other action scenes. But, you know, it's good enough. All the mutants get to show off their powers. Kurt teleports someone in front of the train and then jumps back, which is fun.
Yeah.
Cyclops does some big blasts.
What does Quicksilver do?
Magneto gets to do lots of cool stuff, just like flicking about bits of debris to access shields. At one point, he kind of gets a whole load of guns and uses them to shoot Jessica Chastain, but she's fine.
What does Quicksilver do?
Stays in bed.
See my point?
Yeah, I think the problem is, well, I mean, I say think, almost definitely is the problem. Days of Future Past, they like thought of that really cool scene for Quicksilver.
Yeah.
And then immediately after realised, oh wait, no, we've made a character who can basically just easily resolve everything.
Yeah. The school explosion in Apocalypse, how he saves everybody in that.
Yeah. Like, even in this film, like, all I could think of that whole bit were, like, Jean has to hold the ship together while Nightcrawler tries to rescue, like, the last astronaut.
Yeah.
Quicksilver could have done that in like 3 seconds.
Yep.
That's literally his whole deal. Anyway, then Jean gets off Phoenix-y and explodes the leader of the Dabari and seemingly dies in the process just because. Because she's sick of this franchise as much as we are.
I mean, in the back, what I wanted in the background was I've forgotten his name, the one who plays Charles Xavier, just going, oh, not again.
Oh, James McAvoy.
And then Eric just turned to him and going, what do you mean, not again?
No, or even better, go, well, at least you didn't die this time.
Yeah, this is true.
Anyway, yeah, Jean's dead. Everyone's a bit sad. Xavier quits. Beast takes over the school. The government's apparently fine with mutants again. The school gets renamed the Jean Grey School, which is a reference to the comics where that happened.
Mm.
And then it ends with Charles and Eric playing a nice game of chess, as they do.
Is this back at the commune?
No, this is in Paris, but apparently they're going to go to the commune. The government just let Magneto keep running, even though he's a wanted terrorist again. Sure.
Yeah, so Charles is basically going to join Magneto at the commune as a guest guru, is he?
Yeah, seems like.
They're going to wear linen pants and have loads of beads around their wrists and teach everyone yoga.
Look, given some of their fashions in the comics, I would not be surprised.
That's what I mean.
really, my biggest complaint about this film is that at no point is Michael Fassbender like shirtless but also wearing some kind of long flowing satin dressing gown.
It's the wrong film for that.
I'd like tight white trousers and a red sash.
Yeah. Oh.
Because it would have been something. It would have been something more than just a black trench coat.
I've got a really good thing, really good scene where Magneto's trying to teach Charles meditation. He keeps trying to get Charles to empty his mind. but every time Charles empties his mind, somebody else's thought just keeps coming in.
Still would have been better than this movie.
I know.
Yeah. There are many things that would have been better than this movie.
Can we not just talk about Godzilla again?
It's like, it's even, I would say it's probably more technically accomplished than, say, X-Men Origins Wolverine, or probably The Last Stand. But it's just, at least those movies have bits that are enjoyable.
See, I'll be honest, if I had to choose between this and Last Stand as to which one I'd prefer to watch, I'd go with Last Stand. I do not like this film at all. This Dark Phoenix film is just, it didn't push any of my buttons at all.
I do think, however, it has got one thing that can be said for it. It marks a level of consistency rarely seen in such a long-running franchise.
See, the thing is, at least The Last Stand had some actual events that were, they were majestic in a way. You know, the whole thing with Magneto and the bridge. Jean just basically disintegrating everything around her. And that whole final bit where Wolverine, you see him basically healing but disintegrating at exactly the same time when he goes to kill her.
Yeah, that's like, it had some actual fun spectacle to it.
Yeah. This
was
basically a bunch of people wearing normal clothes slapping each other in the face.
And I think that's where Last Stand wins, is because it, for all its flaws, it still was recognisably an X-Men movie, whereas this was generic superhero movie number 49.
Yeah. Last Stand knew it was a comic book movie and tried to play to that strength.
Yeah.
It didn't succeed, but it was still far more enjoyable than Dark Phoenix.
I've thought of another plus for Dark Phoenix.
We're really pushing this, aren't we?
No, this is a genuine point in its favour.
Oh.
It wasn't 3 hours long. It just felt like it.
That's very true.
Yeah.
No one was more pleasantly surprised than I to notice that it was still daylight out when I came out of the cinema. Surprised, but pleasantly so.
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess that's a feel-good moment that you don't get with a lot of movies, realising that, oh, I've still got most of the afternoon left.
Yeah.
See, I had, when I went to see Godzilla, I had the exact opposite. I was like, oh, that was shorter than I thought it was going to be. I wanted it to be longer.
Well, this is the thing. I went to see Dark Phoenix and it felt longer than Infinity War.
Yeah.
Yeah, it did.
Yes.
Actually, can I admit something on this podcast?
Go on then.
If not for the fact that I was watching it specifically so we could talk about it, I think I would have walked out of Dark Phoenix.
Yeah, I am the same. I'll be honest, I rarely walk out of films because my mum raised me never to waste money and to always get my money's worth. You guys know this. But Dark Phoenix, it was about half an hour into the film and I was just getting angrier and angrier the more I was watching, just thinking, this is not a comic book movie.
I'll be honest. If it hadn't been for the fact that I knew I was going to be on Cinema Eclectica reviewing it, I wouldn't have gone at all.
Fair enough.
Mainly because, and, you know, I've mentioned this several times, I've got up to, but not including Dark Phoenix, I own the entire X-Men franchise on Blu-ray, and I have watched them all multiple times, and it is possibly the least memorable movie franchise in the world. I couldn't tell you. You've just gone through a load of stuff that happened in X-Men Last Stand. I remember all that happening. I just couldn't tell you which film it was in. And Dark Phoenix maintains that level of meh.
Yeah.
Do you know what my favourite thing about Dark Phoenix was?
The ending?
No, a bit after the end when I went home and played some X-Men Legends 2. That's a good
yes,
game.
Yes, it is. It's a fantastic game. X-Men Legends and X-Men Legends 2 were amazing games. People don't realise just how good those games are.
See, I don't know. That kind of gave up on the first X-Men Legends. It's a bit of a slog.
It is a bit of a slog, but, you know, in terms of being a superhero video game, in terms of being an X-Men video game, the actual game itself was a bit of a grind, but the actual storyline was dyed-in-the-wool comic book magic.
Yeah, to be fair, I guess my opinion was very heavily colored by the fact that just I have a better version of this game I could be playing instead.
Yes, which was X-Men Legends 2, which is easily a better version of the game.
I think we can take a break. Why am I not aware of this game? And that's because it's original Xbox. It predates my Xbox career.
Oh, yeah, this is back in like the wastelands of the mid-2000s.
Yeah, PlayStation 2 for me, it was, not Xbox.
Yeah, but it predates my console owning days.
Yeah, my version is PS2, technically.
I've got the Ultimate Alliance games as well, which were not as good, I thought. Anyway.
Well, I don't really like the Ultimate Alliance games.
Ultimate Alliance 2 was good, but I don't know.
Oh, yeah, 2.
Next up on Press X.
Yeah, we're going to take a break there. We'll continue this during the break. We'll be back soon with the comics we've been reading.
Hi there, I'm Robert Rankin, and you're listening to the Geek Show. Oh, yes.
Hello, do you like films? Well, wow, that's good. We're over the first hurdle. If you like films and you also like podcasts, you should probably check out the Geek Show's only dedicated movie podcast, Cinema Eclectica. Well staffed with a trained array of helper monkeys, we review all of the latest films every week and do it reasonably well.
Hello and welcome back to Four Panel. And now the bit that you've all been waiting for, stuff what we've read with our eyes. And kicking us off this week is Rob.
Yes, hello. And so I'm kicking off with Spider-Gwen, Ghost Spider, and this is from Spider-Geddon. Now, if you remember back when I covered Spider-Geddon, there was a section of Spider-Geddon where Spider-Gwen, Gwen Stacy, got disappeared from that particular reality, and she got stuck somewhere else because her interdimensional thingamabob got taken, damaged, whatever. And so this is basically the story of what happened to her while she was in another reality. And it starts off before Spider-Geddon, when she's basically doing her rounds as Spider-Gwen. She stops a woman being mugged and then the woman gives her a hug while the bad guys run screaming from her because she's Spider-Gwen. And then she's basically doing her usual thing of wandering around, just basically being Gwen Stacy, until she gets pulled into the Spider-Geddon thing. And then Gwen Stacy goes into this reality where she isn't Spider-Gwen. She is actually the Green Goblin. But the Green Goblin, who's a good guy, where this reality's Harry Osborn was Spider-Man.
Okay.
Yeah, this is where it starts getting bizarre. Because the Green Goblin in this is actually turned into a bad guy who's going around damaging stuff. Mary Jane knows who's Spider-Man, who's Green Goblin, everything like that. And so in order to try and hop dimensions again, Gwen has to save the Green Goblin, Gwen Stacy, and the two of them have to work together to build an interdimensional key that will give her access to the other dimensions again. And then they do that, they sort things out, and so she can hop across dimensions again, but then the scene shifts to the aftermath of Spider-Geddon and the whole thing about William Braddock, who is the Captain Britain Spider-Man, isn't he?
Yep.
Yeah, he was. But the whole thing about William Braddock, and it starts off with Gwen just basically playing the drums and crying while she's playing the drums, and she just keeps beating on the drums repeatedly while she's crying and just remembering William Braddock. And she decides to take it on herself to basically go to each of the realities where they lost a spider and tell them what happened. Tell the people who loved these members of the Spider Corps, whatever you want to call it, exactly what happened, to close the doors on those haunted houses, as she says. And since she's the only person who can do it, she takes it on herself to do it. It gets a bit emotional at times. Spider-Man Noir was kind of rough because I like Spider-Man Noir.
Yeah, I like Spider-Man Noir too. Dan Slott and Christos Gage.
Yeah. And the thing is, when she goes to Spider-Man Noir's reality and then she meets the Black Cat of that reality, I forgot from Spider-Man Noir the Black Cat of that reality has like the horribly disfigured face with all the scars.
But she does also have a cool mask.
Yes, she does. This is one of those weird ones because the ending is basically the same as the beginning. Gwen basically stops some guys mugging a woman. The woman gives her a hug and says, "I'm glad you're back." And then after that, Spider-Ham turns up to take Gwen away because there's another emergency.
Isn't there always?
Yeah. And says to her, "We'll have you back in a jiffy." I like this. This is one of those additions to a crossover event that Marvel does where it's actually worth reading. And this one's by Sean and Maguire. It's got art by Rosie Camper with Takeshi Miyazawa. Colours by Ian Herring and letters by VC's Clayton Cowles. It's really well put together and it fills in the blanks a great deal, and it also gives you a bit of catharsis about the end of Spider-Geddon. It's everything you want from something that's an addition to a crossover event. So if you like the Spider-Geddon crossover event, this is an absolute must.
Well, that's cool. And in sharp contrast to that, I have Shuri, The Search for Black Panther, by Nnedi Okorafor, art by Leonardo Romero, colours by Jordi Belair, with letters by VC's Joe Sabino. So this is kind of similar to how Spider-Gwen ties into Spider-Verse. This ties into the current Black Panther run, where Black Panther's gone to space and has got involved in some shenanigans there. Guys, I haven't read the series, but I think I managed to black it okay.
Hey, there ain't no shenanigans sketchier than space shenanigans.
Yeah. So, for the first issue and a bit, I quite enjoyed this series because it's about Shuri sort of trying to sort of build a name for herself and be more than just kind of Black Panther's sister who sometimes fills in for him. And she's got all these like new weird aspects to her. She's a scientific genius, like in the films. But she also had a period where she died and came back to life. And now she can like commune with the ancestors and has weird magic powers. Like she can turn her skin to stone and turn into a flock of ravens. But then it kind of falls apart a bit. Because the plot is a bit all over the place. Like it starts with her kind of trying to decide whether or not she's going to take over as the Black Panther again, now that T'Challa is missing. But then said, like, she decides to go looking for him in space. And you know she's not going to find him, so it feels like that issue is a bit of a waste of time. And as well, because it's a thing that, Mick, you've complained about a lot, and I'll admit it's kind of started to grate on me a bit now. But it's like, Shuri goes into space, and oh, look at that, she just happens to bump into Rocket Raccoon and Groot. Those other popular Marvel characters who are in a successful film franchise.
Mm.
Yeah. I mean, it is really, really annoying, isn't it?
Yeah, especially because like the whole point of this series is supposed to be about Shuri kind of building her own independence and, you know, being more than just discount Black Panther. But I feel like it dilutes that a bit when it keeps feeling the need to shove loads of other characters in. Like, it's all right with Storm, because she's Black Panther's girlfriend/wife. But, you know, it's like Rocket and Groot, and then Iron Man. Iron Man shows up in, like, the final issue of this, which really takes a lot of wind out the sails. And also in issue 5, I guess the closest the series has to a central villain. Because issues 1 and 2 are, like, political machinations. Then 3 is suddenly, oh, look, giant space insect eating all the energy. But then, surprise, actually, it's an earthquake dude called Moses Magnum. He's the real threat.
Moses
Magnum, yes. And it's just, none of it feels particularly cohesive. Especially because it keeps moving away from the stuff that's actually kind of interesting. Which is all this political drama about, like, Wakanda wanting a new Black Panther, even though he's not officially the ruler anymore, as of trying to keep up appearances to other nations because they don't want to appear like they've been weakened. But that, I feel like, is a more interesting basis for plot than just Wah Space Monster and Moses Magnum. Also, I'll be honest, the art I do not like. Like, it does a pretty good job of sort of background scenes filming with lots of nice detail. But, oh, the faces are very bad. Like, everyone just seems to have a look of blank surprise at all times. Didn't enjoy it.
Okay.
Well,
it is most definitely going in the bin.
Right. My turn, I guess, then.
Yep.
All right, so I've been reading Olivia Twist, which is a, as you may imagine, a reimagining of Oliver Twist by Darren Strauss, Adam Dalva, and art by Emma Viacelli and Lee LaFridge. And this is from Dark Horse Comics and their Berger Books imprint. And basically, what this is a kind of cyber steampunk reimagining of Oliver Twist. Only it isn't. Not really.
Oh, well, that clears it all up.
Yeah. However, what it does is it takes those workhouse, servile, drudgery themes and elements from Oliver Twist, and, it has to be said, other works of Charles Dickens and that kind of social literature of the late 19th century.
Yeah.
And puts it firmly in a future state where America has been wiped out by an electromagnetic pulse, and all the Americans that are left have come to London and inhabit a place called Vertical City. And it's it's quite cliched in so much as all the rich and wealthy people inhabit Vertical City, the skyscraper, and all the workhouse people are in camps and hovels on the ground. But basically, Olivia Twist is an orphan. She's in a workhouse and she manages to escape and rescues a boy called Pip. And then there's a hunt by the bad guy for her because it's important who her parents were. She joins up with a group called the Esters, who were run by a female Fagin. And the Esters are a rebellious group who are, they're not the, although they are the thieves and vagabonds of Oliver Twist, they do so with a purpose. Their purpose is not just to sort of get the bits and pieces they need to survive and thrive as a group. They're trying to stage a revolution. They're part of an underground movement. And they all bring their own particular skills to bear in bringing that about. And there's various plots. I don't want to give too many spoilers away. If you are familiar with the story of Oliver Twist, this is not adequate preparation for Olivia Twist. It's quite, there's a lot of double crossing, a lot of triple crossing in some cases. It's a long time before you get to understand the motivation of the villain, which I think is possibly the one criticism I've got about it. The art is quite nice. It's a bit reminiscent of the art style of Porcelain, but not quite as accomplished.
Okay.
It's got a lot of twists and turns. It's got a lot of social commentary about how we treat immigration and immigrants, about how we treat minorities, how we treat poor. There's a lot of parallels with things that are in the news currently, which you would expect from something that is a reworking of a work by Dickens. Is it an enjoyable read? Is it a good comic book? Yes. Is it an enjoyable read? For the most part, yes. But some of the storylines are a bit uncomfortable to read, but rightly so because of what they're covering.
Okay.
There's a big reveal around Pip, which is only, it's kind of telegraphed, but in a way that you don't really realise until after. if you see what I mean. Is it
that he's from the wrong Dickens story?
No, because this is the point. The core of it takes the plot of Oliver Twist, but there's little nods to the rest of the Dickens literary universe.
Yeah, I know. I was kidding. It's not a flat adaptation of Oliver Twist.
No, it's... I mean, the iconic, "Please, sir, I want some more," is in there. But it's a very different interpretation of that whole scene. And that's the point at which she befriends Pip and defends him against the equivalent of Mr. Bumble.
Okay, so it's no Sherlock Holmes of the future.
No. It's kind of, you can see where the DNA comes from. The DNA is definitely Dickensian, but it's if Dickens wrote a comic book set in the future.
Who's to say he didn't?
Sorry?
Who's to say he didn't?
Well, I think someone will probably have published it by now, and I'd be reviewing this and calling it a blatant rip-off of that piece of work by Dickens.
I'm just saying, they're always finding random works from, like, famous people in attics and hidden inside books and stuff like that all over the world.
Okay. Well,
hunting for Dickens' lost cyberpunk masterpiece. Why don't you tell us about the next book you're reading, Rob?
Sword Daughter, Volume 2. And this is called Folded Metal. This is by Brian Wood and Mac Chater with Jose Villarubia and Nate Picos. This continues the story of Dag and Elspeth Dag's daughter, who are on a quest of vengeance against the 40 Swords, who 10 years previously went to their village and killed a lot of people, including Dag's wife, Elspeth's mother. And so they've killed a couple of the 40 Swords already, but they're still on the hunt for more. But the more they kill, the bigger the bounty on their head becomes. And so now they're being hunted by the remnants of the 40 Swords, and they're doing what they can to hunt them while at the same time being hunted. And this has basically gone from having a lot of the early part of Vinland Saga, when Thorfinn was still very violent and was just wanting vengeance on Askeladd, to having a lot of elements of, say, Lone Wolf and Cub in there as well. So,
sure. The problem is, Rob, what you've also described is a Benny Hill sketch.
Yeah, I know. But imagine a Benny Hill sketch where every time they pass each other, someone's head gets cut off.
I mean, that still works.
And so you have this whole thing where it does what it does in the first volume. You have the two different time periods. You have Elspeth as an adult, where she's lost an eye in some random battle. And you have Elspeth as a young girl following her dad. And they're, you know, she still doesn't speak that much. She does say some words in this volume, but most of what she speaks is in kind of a sign language. Her dad's trying to teach her a passcode for a place that's supposed to be safe, but humans being humans, no place is safe in the face of money. But while they're at that place, which is kind of like a convent, I suppose, for warrior nuns, maybe they are, I don't know, but they teach Elspeth the basics of fighting with a sword. Thing is, it's got some amazing imagery, and it does build up the story of the characters quite a lot, the story of Dag and Elspeth. Dag knows that what he should have done was basically look after Elspeth and raise her properly and have a peaceful life, but he can't do that because of reasons. There's a great scene where the matriarch of these elderly female warrior nuns is questioning Dag about why was his village attacked? Why was it his wife that was killed? Why did he choose to pick up a sword and go and get vengeance on the 40 Swords 10 years later? Why now? And why is he taking his daughter with him? Trying to force him to think, trying to force him to confront the reasons why he's doing things, the reasons for his actions, because they don't think that this journey of vengeance is the place for a young girl. But Elspeth has different ideas, and she is, well, this is basically the story of how you make a monster. Because she's brutal, she's vicious, and at the end of it, bit of a daddy's girl as well. But they only have each other. I am really liking Sword Daughter. It's really shaping into, I mean, the artwork's visceral, it's sketchy, but the colours are nice. It's got some great costumes in there, especially for the 40 Swords. I really like this. I think it's got a lot to recommend it. And as I said before, if you're a fan of Vinland Saga or you're a fan of any of those Viking TV programs, you're going to love this. It really is good. Oh, and the other thing is, they don't have any of those pithy lines like the hunter becomes the hunted. They don't do any of that nonsense, which is good in my book.
What? But I think you're legally entitled to at some point yell out, but who is the hunter and who is the prey?
Yeah, they don't do that either.
But who swords the sword daughter?
The sword daughter is the daughter of the person who has the sword, who is her dad, who is Dag. But Dag also knows how to forge swords and tries teaching her about folded metal, which is why it's got the line folded metal. And basically, it's a metaphor for how she is also being folded and forged into a weapon herself. Hence the name Sword Daughter.
Look, I'm just stalling because I've got no idea how to segue into my book.
Yeah, just go for it.
It's Archie meets Batman 66.
All right, yeah, that is difficult.
It's in no way similar to Sword Daughter.
That's a difficult one.
So this is a story by Jeff Parker and Michael Marecki, pencils by Dan Parent, inks by Jay Bone, colouring by Kelly Fitzpatrick, and letters by Jack Morelli.
Do you know the weird thing, Andrew? When you hummed that Benny Hill theme tune, that was the perfect segue.
Oh, no, it was. Curse me for a fool. So, this series starts off in Gotham. And you know what? Joker, Riddler, Penguin and Catwoman are fed up. Fed up of that gosh darn Batman always meddling in their schemes.
Is he not letting Joker put boners all over the place?
He is not. But they come up with an ingenious idea. Why is it that they keep trying to become the crime lord of Gotham City? The one city that has a Batman to stop them. Surely it would make more sense to take over somewhere small first. Somewhere without any meddling superheroes to get in the way of their plans. Somewhere like Riverdale, the home of America's favourite teen, Archie Andrews. And so, yeah, we cut over to Archie and the gang. They're having their usual fun time adventures. And suddenly they notice all the adults in Riverdale have been mind-controlled. And, you know, the only way to save their city is to team up with Batman, Robin and Batgirl to take down the villains.
But how do they know to call Batman if they're in Riverdale? Or is Riverdale a suburb of Gotham?
They've got a really bright bat signal.
No, I just want Riverdale to be a suburb of Gotham. It would explain a lot. It would explain that TV series for a start.
The real answer is basically by accident. Which I love. That's such a Batman 66 thing that, like, Batman picks up the phone and goes, random teens ringing the Batcave. Hey, what's going on?
It actually fits as well, doesn't it?
Just this book is absolutely delightful. Because it's got everything you'd want from Batman. It's got the silliness. It, of course, has the sound effects. There's even one bit where they do a, like, spinning Logos-style transition from one scene to the next.
I remember you didn't want to review this.
You know what? I didn't. Because I feel like I've kind of... Riverdale has kind of made me forget about, like, goofy old-fashioned Archie.
Yeah.
And just how much fun that can be, especially paired with, like, just the fine cheese that is the 1966 Batman.
Oh, God, yeah. I mean, why do you think I covered that, you know, the Archie versus Predator ages ago?
Because it's just ridiculous.
Yeah. And
there's also a bit where Robin, Batgirl and Jughead get tied up in a torture room, which is just a giant monkey banging cymbals until their brains melt.
That sounds like a proper Batman 66 thing.
I just thought, it's possibly one of my favourite lines is just Batman, you know, the fiends subjecting them to monkey cymbal torture. Also, of course, there's only one way to bring Jughead round from after this torture. Shoving hamburgers in his face.
Yes, because Jughead loves his hamburgers.
Also, there's a fun bit where, like, they're looking at their plan, at like the villains' collective plans. I was like, Catwoman's go-go club, Penguin's ice palace, Joker's amusement park. And then Veggie, who's one of Archie's friends, is like, I mean, this all sounds pretty fun, actually.
It's true. Oh.
But yeah, this was just a delightful anathema to the, like, dim dourness that was Dark Phoenix. Just lovely, bright cheeriness.
Yeah. Also an anathema to the Riverdale TV series.
Yeah.
Have I ever mentioned that I did not like that show?
No one in Riverdale does the Batusi.
What? Are they heathens?
I think they must be. Yeah, so I think, is this a good note when in the show one?
Yeah.
On this, surprisingly, we've come at the other end on a positive note.
Yes, we have. A surprisingly positive note. Because after all the stick that DC gets for their weird crossovers.
Yeah, I mean, to be fair, Batman 66 and Archie, I couldn't really think of a more perfect combination.
This is true.
It's all the wholesome values a growing boy needs.
Yes. Oh, right. Okay. So on that wholesome note, we are at the end of the show. So if you want to catch up with any of our previous episodes, you'll find them all on our website, thegeekshow.co.uk, or you'll find them on Audioboom or Apple Podcasts or whichever podcast provider that you're using. On our website as well, you'll also find our Patreon, our shop, and all the other things that we do. We're also doing some E3 coverage this week, so check out the videos on our YouTube channel. Just head to YouTube and look for The Geek Show. Until next week, then, I've been Rob.
I've been Andrew.
And I've been Mick.
And we will see you all later.
Thanks for listening.
Goodbye now.